This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Hello and welcome to The Pulse, Issues in Healthcare, the podcast where leaders share their thoughts on the healthcare issues of the day. I'm Leslie Bruce, your host and the Director of Healthcare Leadership and Community Outreach for UC San Diego Extension. Today, I am honored to have Congresswoman Susan Davis, who represents the 53rd District of California. Congresswoman Davis has a long and distinguished career, having served 9 years on the San Diego Unified School Board, 6 years in the California Assembly, and now over 14 years in Congress. She currently serves on the House Armed Services Committee, a perfect assignment for military-rich San Diego, and on the Education and Workforce Committee, which, of course, fits well with both her background and our regional needs for a skilled workforce. Welcome, Congresswoman Davis.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I'm delighted, delighted. So first, let me thank you for making the time to meet with the high school students at the UC San Diego Global Environmental Leadership Program last week in Washington.
They were delightful.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it. And your constituent really was so impressed and so delighted that you would listen to her. So they're learning to be advocates and caring for the earth, and they really appreciated your time. So before we go into your work in Congress, please share with us your education and early career journey. What did you do before you ran for office?
Well, before I ran for office, going back, I happened to be a graduate of UC Berkeley. In fact, I even am willing to share with people that I was there during the free speech movement.
Oh, all right.
And I always, the one thing is that I never thought I would certainly go into politics. I wanted to be a social worker, I think. I actually believe that for women, some of our roles were kind of limited in those days. And I thought about even going into medicine and being a psychiatrist at one time, but it was a lot easier to be a social worker. And I didn't have to go through medical school. I didn't have to do all the chemistry, which I was told that I, you know, was too difficult.
Oh, my.
And it happened today, but it happened then. And I pursued the field of social work and sociology at Berkeley. And then I went on to get a master's degree in social work and actually found myself doing a number of different things and somehow migrated into politics. It wasn't by purposeful. I didn't think about it.
Isn't that amazing? I remember another elected official, Lucy Calais, saying, you know, that politics is not bad for her fifth or sixth career. So it's amazing that people need to start thinking in terms of those. It's not necessarily what you start out to be.
Yeah. And the amazing thing today, of course, is that people can have many different careers, and women particularly can have many different careers.
And I think that's really an important message to get out. So how did it feel what motivated you to run the first time?
When I came to San Diego after having, you know, been in other places, I grew up in Northern California, and we actually were in Japan during the Vietnam War. My husband was serving there, and my two young children and I were able to be there. And we came to California looking for a place to settle down. And San Diego, just by chance, really became that place. We didn't know people here. And because I had been active in my kids' preschool and found some real affinity with people who were active in the League of Women Voters. And it really was through League that I started learning more about San Diego and some of the needs we have in San Diego, met some people that were active in politics and started participating in just, you know, some of the initiatives that League was involved in. And I just happened to be, in some ways, at the right place at the right time. But I also was helping a neighbor to run for the school board, and when she decided not to do it, I was one of the only ones standing at that point. And I really wanted to make the schools better. I just saw myself doing it more behind the scenes than as a school board member. But I actually thoroughly enjoyed that experience on the school board, and it led to a number of other things.
I think it certainly did. Well, you know, I think about you and your sort of accidental journey, and you know, we're really not keeping up with women in politics. We need more women to run. And how do we plant that seed earlier? How do you think we could help motivate women to run for office?
Well, more women out there are going to encourage more young women to do that. We always, you know, make the statement that you can't be what you can't see. And so it is important for young people to see that, you know, women can be president of the United States. Women can be the vice president of the United States. That certainly was my experience many, many years ago. That we saw that someone could actually, you know, be a candidate for vice president initially. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is important. But having ways that young women, particularly who have an interest in politics, but maybe even just want to learn more how to be an active participant in just about anything that they do, because sometimes we know that women can be dismissed. Mm-hmm. Often we say that it's so interesting that you could put out an idea and nobody picks it up until, you know, somebody down the line says it, and it usually isn't a woman.
Yes, right. So, and then it's a brilliant idea.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we all experience that. Mm-hmm. So what I talk about is rehearsal time for young women to find those opportunities where maybe it's a little less risky than some other things that they might try and do, like jumping in and running for the highest office, but they're interested, even if it's a position at work, they're volunteering to do something that takes a skill level that maybe they don't even feel they have, but they want to demonstrate and learn. Try all those things out. It's so helpful. And then people begin to discover what a great job you do. Mm-hmm. It's only through that that I think you develop that network of people who have confidence in you and push you forward, especially when you don't, you know, you don't feel as confident as maybe those around you feel in your ability to do something.
I think that's a great suggestion, and I try to motivate women in the classroom, you know, whether they're high school or grad student or whatever, to look at this as an opportunity to lead, and, you know, and not to close any doors, for sure.
Right. You're opening up many of those avenues.
Well, I think it's wonderful. And Run Women Run is one of those organizations that I think gives exactly. women the, you know, got your back kind of feel that yeah. they can, that they're not alone in the effort to run for office. I think it's wonderful to have people like you helping to bring women forward.
It's fun.
Oh, good.
I love it.
That's wonderful. Well, let's get to the issues in healthcare then. In the California Assembly, you authored a bill which was signed into law that gave women direct access to their OBGYN without a referral from their primary care physician. I know you introduced similar legislation on the federal side a number of times. Can you tell us what happened with that?
Well, basically, it became part of the Affordable Care Act. I think that what we know today is that there are some needs for renewing some of that so that people have really that full access in terms of their OBGYN. But, you know, at the time, it's so interesting because looking back, people I wouldn't say they thought we were crazy to try and do that, but they didn't really understand and think it was necessary. And I remember speaking to one of, at that time, Governor Pete Wilson's aides, and I said, would you please do me a favor and go home, ask your wife about this? How does she feel about getting a note so she can go to see her OBGYN
right.
from a primary care provider? And he came back and said, you're right. Mm-hmm. She's had some real difficulties with that. And so I think that we were able to clear the way for that legislation.
Well, I think it's fantastic, obviously. And so you say it became part of the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, you know, the Affordable Care Act has been under siege, as you well know. And many of the leading trade groups in the healthcare industry expressed great relief in the media when the Affordable Care Act survived this last Supreme Court case,
right.
King versus Burwell. Do you think that if a Republican president is elected, he or she will still try to repeal it?
I suspect there are some of the candidates today who would do that. But I'm not so sure that the public is supportive. I think that we have come far enough now that people understand that they wouldn't want these rights taken away. I mean, the ability for people who have pre-existing conditions to get health care today is really important. Mm-hmm. And so I'm certainly hopeful that that's not going to happen.
I'm hopeful as well. I have to admit, I just think about the stability that this last case has brought to the industry, and a big sigh of relief. And I just think it would be extremely disruptive at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I think that we are finding ways of improving the access issues, and we know that there are problems that are going
to
come up. But
I think
the community has come along, and yeah,
they like it. I certainly hope so. Well, so what other healthcare issues are of greatest concern to you at this point?
Well, one thing here that's very important for San Diego, of course, is NIH funding. Mm-hmm. And the last number of years, we've seen a real decline, excuse me, in the number of grants that research institutes are able to be successful at receiving. And it's about a 17% drop. So it's very important that we increase those numbers. And I've been instrumental in trying to bring on board. Now we have at least about half of my colleagues who signed on to the NIH appropriation, which is at $32 billion. The Senate actually just came in with something just slightly higher than that. And so I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to conference those and move forward. It's important to our economy, number one, but it's also important to what we're able to do. I think the other piece of that is the 21st Century Cures Act. And that also is going to focus more dollars, about $8.75 billion in mandated funding. And that's going to be very important. Specifically, when it comes to the issues that I've been working on in healthcare, diabetes is an issue, a concern that we know in our country costs billions and billions of dollars. So we've been working very hard to have the National Diabetes Prevention Act also be applicable under Medicare funding for those prevention activities that we know are really critical. About half of the people in the United States are pre-diabetic, mm-hmm. Seniors over 60 years old. So if we can make a real dent in the ability of people to get the kind of access, the kind of care, and really understanding what it is about their lifestyle and how they really can work together with their providers, that they can begin to maybe not be one of those statistics. That's what we would like.
And it, you know, it's not just diabetes. It's all of the consequences of diabetes, the extremities of the circulation, the eyesight, it's a domino effect. It's not just about insulin.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And for so many of the people that are pre-diabetic, they're not on insulin, mm-hmm. but they become very borderline. And at that point, the opportunity to mitigate more dramatic treatments is very, very possible. And mm-hmm. I think that's why we really have to do that. We've shown that prevention programs can impact this issue. There have been enough pilots by now that mm-hmm. we know that that can happen. I think the statistics are about 58% of individuals can be helped through prevention programs. And that rises to about 71% if people are over the age of 60. So we need to focus on this, and unfortunately, the Medicare prevention bill actually has not had the kind of attention that we think it needs. Certainly, many, many groups and individuals from throughout the country that focus on this issue have been very, very supportive, but getting the Congress to focus and mm-hmm. to add additional monies where they're necessary mm-hmm. is a tough issue. And sure. we actually think it saves money. And certainly with the Cures Act, I mean, we're looking at major savings if we can, over that five-year period of that mandated funding, really make a difference in what we're able to do to help people.
Well, that's exciting. What can people do who are listening to have perhaps to this podcast, what can they do to help support this effort?
Well, I think they can certainly let all the members here in the San Diego delegation know of their interest and their concern. We have a bipartisan delegation here that's been supportive of these issues, but sometimes people's personal stories can be the most helpful. Mm-hmm. And we know that all of us, I mean, almost everybody, certainly all the members of Congress and everyone who's probably listening to your podcast has a story, mm-hmm. Knows someone who either was able to be responsive to some therapies, maybe not able to really live out their lives fully, but mm-hmm. they were able to have those therapies that really made a difference for them. What we want is to be sure that many of these illnesses that we know today are not curable. Mm-hmm. We can provide people with relief, and they certainly can go into remission, but we want to be sure that we tackle those. And through the kinds of funding that the Cures Act is going to address, we'll be able to do that with some of those illnesses that are kind of on the cusp of finding the therapies that are really going to make a difference. And it's going to take all of those efforts, I think, to provide those therapies, to save lives, and certainly to save the kind of funding that people are required to engage in today that is just so expensive. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. We know that that's a very difficult thing to do. We can do better,
right?
But we have to put the research behind it, and we have to put the effort behind it. And I think we can be successful.
Well, I think so too. And I notice you have two bills on diabetes prevention: one for seniors and one that is for obviously non-seniors. But is that focused on anything like children or something in particular?
We're focusing on the prevention.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. And then we've been talking a little bit here about the 21st Century Cures Act. Share with us what that is and the impetus that has been behind it.
Well, it's been a bill long in coming, and it's a bipartisan bill, and one that I think that my colleagues have been going around the country, really, and talking to people about how we can do a better job with this. And so they've looked to a number of markers that people can be studying. They've looked at ways that certainly we can tailor medication to individuals. And as I mentioned earlier, it's really focused on the most promising illnesses and diseases that we have today that we know we're not so far for a cure. So it's, in many ways, it's incentivizing research, it's incentivizing companies, it's incentivizing the government to put out the kind of proposals so that people can begin to really address the cures
that are
out there.
That's exciting.
And it is. It's very exciting. And I think that a number of, it was passed in a bipartisan fashion. I think there were some people that, everyone's always worried about whether or not they want to make that kind of an investment. And mm-hmm. I think in this situation, we have to make that investment. And again, it goes back to the stories. It goes back to the people who are affected by these illnesses, and we can do better, and we should. We must, as a country, we must do better.
As you point out, an ounce of prevention is worth a
Absolutely.
Pound of cure, and if we can take these funds and get to a cure more quickly, how much money we'll save from having done that.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your comment about the stories, too. I think that's something that we're trying to teach students, that it's not all about the data. It's about the stories, the
That's
actual
right.
personal experiences.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is that a lot of students have those stories. They just don't know they have them sometimes. They don't realize. They think about their families. And when they can find within themselves the ability to relate to the illnesses and the stories and what kind of legislation really does make a difference today, mm-hmm. then I think they're going to be, great promoters of making a difference.
Well, I hope they feel inspired to do so. That is for sure. I was noticing you're on a couple of healthcare-related caucuses as well, and so I wanted to ask what they're doing, the Mental Health Caucus and the COPD Caucus. Tell us just briefly what caucuses are and what these two in particular are up to.
Yeah, the caucuses are an opportunity for members, if they're not on a committee necessarily, or even if they are in some cases, to gather with other members who have a similar interest and to bring in speakers and some experts to learn more. And from time to time, they're actually able to, I think, engage more people in the effort. And certainly the mental health community as a whole is been inspired by some of the work actually of our military. I think that the way in which the military, following, and we're still engaged, of course, but following the major deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, we saw so many young people coming home with what we would call the invisible trauma of war. Mm-hmm. And so making certain that people know that they must seek help and find the resources that will help them. And the more that we got out there and talked about this, and the more that the officers got out and talked about that, people started feeling that, you know, that's the new normal in many ways, is to talk about the way that you may be suffering from what can be an illness that is not necessarily so much seen as an illness as a reaction, as a normal way of coping with something really horrible that you experienced.
Right.
And so I think that in many ways the military community is helping all of us, you know, the general population.
That's very
interesting.
Here we are talking about the House Armed Services Committee on which you sit and, you know, bringing those lessons to the broader community.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And to help our soldiers.
And what we've also been able to do, and actually we talked about this, I was at Stand Down this weekend at San Diego High School, which has brought for many, many, many years now, everybody together who, you know, veterans who may still be on the street or not able to get the resources they need, whether it's legal or whether it's health care help, and trying to also go to the veterans and knowing that they can be very helpful to veterans as well. And those who have suffered and have gotten through this process and have, you know, had the kind of difficulties over the last number of years, they can really help one another to sort of look for the signs and to know that they have a great deal of hope as they move forward, and particularly sometimes when they get involved and they're finding that they can be employed, that they, you know, they can get off the streets. All those things are important, but they also know that there's a way that perhaps that they can talk about some of their concerns, their fears. And they can work through this in a very positive fashion. And they do it largely from talking to some of the people who have been there, who have managed to get through that.
That's such a wonderful event, that Stand Down event. I did not know it was moved to the high school.
Yes, it's been in San Diego High School now for some time. And actually, you know, we're sitting here today and it's probably nice outside, but on the day that they had that, of course, over the weekend, They had to make a lot of adjustments in what they did.
I'll bet. Well, let's talk about the Workforce and Education Committee. That's certainly of critical importance to UC San Diego and the Extended Studies Division, as you can imagine, and our students. You sit on the committee. What are the major issues that the committee's working on, and do any impact health in particular?
Well, I think the one that certainly impacts health has to do with nutrition and has to do with, you know, how we move forward and make sure that children who need to get, whether it's free and reduced meals or have some reductions in their school meals, that they're able to do that. Okay. That's very important. And we've been talking to people and working with that. And, of course, there have been some new rules that have come down to school districts across the country, and they're trying to do the best that they can with that. I think that it's not always easy, and so they've had some concerns, but I think we've been trying to work through that, and the Education Committee certainly deals with that, as well as those in, you know, as they look at some of the legislation in the Ag Committee, and the Agriculture Committee also is a very big part of that. I think that in terms of the Education Committee itself, probably the issue that's the most important is to find a way to reauthorize what we all call as No Child Left Behind. It's the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Act. And that act was brought forward as a federal program many, many years ago when we knew that children who were in need needed attention. in order to be successful at school. And that's really the purpose of that legislation. There's a bill that came out of the House side. There's also a bill that just recently came out of the Senate side. And I'm hopeful that we can find a way to bring those together. But they actually express two very different points of view about the federal role in education.
Oh, that's interesting.
And yes,
something I'm sure very near and dear to your heart.
Yes, absolutely. And and as a school board member, I saw that because we all have to make difficult choices whenever it comes to steering funding from one school to another or one area to another. And I think the federal guidelines were actually helpful in that way because they were those guideposts, really, that helped with that decision making. And there is an attempt on the House side in the bill that came out of that committee, basically takes away some of that federal role. I'm a strong believer in local control. Absolutely. I think school board members need to make those decisions because they work daily.
They're on the ground.
They're on the ground, and you're never more closer to your constituent than you are as a school board member, representing moms and dads and families who care about their children. They want nothing but the best for their children. But it also is important for us to be sure that the children who need that care, need that support, really, need whether it's additional teachers in the classroom or assistants or special programs from time to time, that those children are able to receive that kind of support. And the federal guidelines are helpful in that way. So we'll see what happens. I'm hopeful that we can come together.
When do you think it's going to be resolved by the end of the year?
We've been at this for a while, so I certainly hope so.
Oh, I do too. I do too. You know, I'm always conscious of the healthcare workforce. Are there any things, obviously the medical research funding will go a long way to help with that. I'm just wondering if there are anything else, given there are shortages in some professions. I don't know if there's a role for the federal government there, but I would be curious as to your take.
It's certainly important for us to know the implications of many of these issues. And I think that the Affordable Care Act, you know, was one that highlighted the need for far more primary care providers. And so in schools today, there are programs that help young people and introduce young people early to this issue. We have a number of schools around San Diego Unified, of course, and out in the counties as well, that have some programs that really do help grow our own. And that's very important. I know there are programs where we have health advocates at the high school level. Having been involved in Hoover High School many years ago on the school board and the health center that was developed there, and one of the roles that they found was students needed to be the health advocates, not the adults, but the students.
There's that peer-to-peer again.
Absolutely.
It just works wonders.
Peer-to-peer, that's so significant. And so I think we need to do that. The other thing that really ties a lot of this together is something that I've been involved in, and it comes out of my social work experience, I think, also working in the schools, of course, and being in the state legislature on these issues, as well as in Congress, and having been involved in the Aaron Price Fellows Program also, is this what we call, and it's partly civics, but social-emotional learning. And the San Diego Unified School District now is taking a very strong look at this, because what it does is engage our teaching professionals in understanding how to embed, how to make this a part of everything that they teach, so that young people are able to relate their experiences to what they're learning. Now, this is not a new concept, but I think that we have a lot of people who've been working to see what is the best way to do that. And it actually comes under what makes for a safe and secure school environment. Because when kids are comfortable that they can talk about what's going on and they can provide those examples so their peers understand why they feel the way they do as well, and they can connect it and they can see what is significant about what they're learning, even historically, that can make a real difference. And it can create a better, safe environment We have a very diverse community. Mm-hmm. Kids come from many, many different backgrounds.
Sure.
And they all bring all these experiences with them that are so enriching.
Right.
If they can feel comfortable talking about them and teaching about them. Mm-hmm. So children can learn through this. And so part of what we call the social emotional learning taps some of those needs that we have in school. And that's an effort. We've been able to make that part of the education bills that have been passed. But at the same time, you know, we know that that's not an effort that's necessarily being funded in a way that makes sense. Mm-hmm. School districts, however, though, can learn about this, and they can use some funding that they have to bring in these kinds of programs. So while it doesn't specifically give them the funding, it does allow them to use that. And we find that very positive. And I'm so delighted that the superintendent of San Diego Unified School District, Cindy Martin, mm-hmm. is taking full advantage of that. And they've recently applied for a federal grant, and we're very hopeful that they're going to receive that. That will be very positive. And sometimes this happens, as you know, in one school or another. It doesn't happen throughout the district. But the more of our teaching professionals who are able to really engage with young people at this level and know how to do that, you know, how to bring in those experiences of young kids, mm-hmm. We think that can be very, very positive.
Oh, I can certainly understand that. And, you know, open the students' eyes to all sorts of things, you know, not just different backgrounds, but different ways of doing things and different opportunities that might be available. Well, one of the last things I wanted to cover is working on a congressional staff. You know, I think every time I am with students who get the opportunity to come visit with you or another member of the House or the Senate, they look at those staffers who are usually remarkably young, and so they're fascinated with this idea. And so tell us, what kinds of positions are typically available in a legislator's office? Let's just stick with the House for now. Mm-hmm. What's available there? What are the opportunities for young people and maybe not so young people?
Yeah, well, I think just starting with the opportunities that young people have to spend some time in a congressional office, not necessarily to be hired on in a position, but to be an intern, because we'd like to think that our opportunities that we give our interns are really terrific, mm-hmm. and that they learn a great deal. And the amount of time, if they spend, in some cases, you know, 3 days a week, and they're putting in a good few hours, they learn a very important lesson, I think, that has to do with how do you deal with a public that isn't always, you know, going to be happy and cheerful when they call you and when they interact with you. Mm-hmm. And so our interns, I think, find out very quickly how they can use their own skills to do that without getting into elaborate discussions with people, but just being supportive, mm-hmm. being friendly, and listening. Mm-hmm. We all know that listening is a very important skill to have.
Absolutely.
And one that, you know, is not so easy. And I think sometimes if you're young and you're energetic and you feel like, you know, you want to tell people
what
you know, and helping them listen to people and what it is that they need, and reminding them that if the way in which they talk to that person in the office as well tells them something about how this person may be getting help, or in some cases not having people listen to them because they're screaming or they're unhappy and they're not, you know, able to take advantage of some of that help. So I think that's really important. And in addition to the wonderful skill sets that we get from them, certainly in computers and everything else, probably that is the key. Helping them, you know, understand that we're there to help people. And if mm-hmm. we can do that, if we can help navigate, you know, the federal bureaucracies for people. We have all kinds of calls that come in, as you know, from
Absolutely.
Social Security
yeah.
and certainly immigration needs, and how do I deal with this issue or that. Sometimes people call us on things that the federal government really is not the key mm-hmm. Agency to talk to, the key government, but we can direct them mm-hmm. to other entities, and the students learn a lot from that. Mm-hmm. The entry level positions that we have really have to do with helping us return the mail, helping us respond to mail. Mm-hmm. What is it that they bring in their writing skills particularly? And this is very, very important. When we have an opening at the entry level, whether it's a receptionist level, mm-hmm. or also helping to with correspondence, what we find is that young people are just terrific when you talk to them, but sometimes they just don't have those writing skills. And so we're in a position where we really have to be careful that we hire young people who can do that, because we don't have the ability to really train for that.
Sure.
We can help them. We can certainly provide the specific information that they need to address that letter. But we also know that, you know, that it's a special skill in being able to respond, to be empathic in a letter, and yet to be direct about the information that's needed. And so we find that this is very, very important. And we engage all of our staff in writing letters to constituents as well. And of course, I'm a part of that. Mm-hmm. But really, that's because we get so many. And today with email,
oh sure,
you know, it's not atypical to have 1,500 letters and needs for responses, just about every week. So mm-hmm. So that's something that we do a lot of, and that's important. And then we have, of course, legislative assistants that are in the office working specifically on different kinds of legislation. In San Diego, of course, people do a lot more community work, mm-hmm. because that's a lot of their focus. They're involved in the legislation and being helpful and listening and finding actually new ideas for legislation. But it's really their job is to interface more with the community mm-hmm. here in San Diego. And I've just been delighted. I've always had very strong, loyal staff who've been with me for a long time.
You certainly
have. And we've done very well when we do have people who go on and get other degrees or find another mm-hmm. Area where they want to work. That's always exciting to have them move on. Mm-hmm. But I think that for young people who are just thinking about wanting to do this, if they have the time to come in and be an intern for a period of time, either in Washington or in San Diego, we think we can give them just an incredible experience, and we are really grateful for that support.
Well, that's terrific. I hope people are listening and take advantage of that. I know there are formal internship programs, and then perhaps there are some informal ones, that you don't necessarily have to be a formal house internship, or is it possible to even volunteer?
Oh, yes. And certainly, I mean, the interns are basically volunteering because mm-hmm. we're not able to pay them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we think that the experience and the resume building for them is really good. And they also, if they're here in San Diego, then they go out to community groups with the representative to have a chance to know what's going on. For community events, of course, they play a very important role being there and assisting in whatever's needed. And they contribute so much. It's wonderful.
It is, and another opportunity that I tell students, and my husband says this is even better than a dating service, is to get involved in a campaign.
Absolutely.
If you get involved in a campaign, you're going to meet people who share your values, and you're in, it's all for one and one for all, and you're in the bunker together getting it all done. And so you might have experience with encouraging people to participate in that way as well.
Yes.
It's really fun. You learn a lot. You can get a lot of responsibility as a young person. Another thought.
You need people, and I
Absolutely.
Think you were asking earlier about my experiences, because if it hadn't been for participating in campaigns many years ago, then I don't think there's any way that I would have even entertained the notion of being a legislator, a politician,
sure.
Certainly a congresswoman. It would have been so far from anything that I could have imagined. But at the same time, seeing the way things work, and sometimes looking at the situation and saying, I could do that.
I could do that. Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Well, that's very interesting, and hopefully it will inspire people like you, who will then be brave.
Yeah.
and get involved, because I think we need more people like that. I want to close just a little bit on a hopeful note. You mentioned the 21st Century Cures Act and how bipartisan that was. And we had the SGR, the Sustainable Growth Rate, that what better known as the DOC fix, passed with bipartisan support. You know, the public constantly is telling the, you know, pollsters and legislators how much they value bipartisanship. Do you feel, and you're a very bipartisan work with anybody kind of person, you have that reputation. How do you think we're doing? Are we getting better? Is it getting any better? And if not, what can we do?
Yeah. On an individual level, I think that people do make efforts, do develop friendships, and do get through some of the, what people see is the rivalry. I think the difficulty has been for at least the last half of the time that I've been in Congress, more so than the first part of that, is what we know happens with elections and with primary campaigns, and the sense that people are always going to deal with an opponent, perhaps, who pushes them further than they are in one way or another. And, it's maybe the Cures Act is a good example of this, because I was walking with some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle as we walk sort of through the basement, basically, to vote, especially when it's very hot and humid in Washington. Mm-hmm. And one of these colleagues I know pretty well. I've worked with him and you know, respect his work. We don't agree on everything. But I asked, thinking, well, are y'all supportive of the Cures Act? And they basically said, oh, this is really difficult, because, I'm afraid that if I vote for this, that somebody will say that I'm, spending too much money. And so because I'm afraid of that in my primary, I'm not able to support this, even though I believe it's the right thing to do.
Oh, dear. That's
so
disheartening.
So you run across that, and that does drive people. Mm-hmm. And I would have hoped that on an issue like this, that people could really put that aside, mainly because I think you can go to constituents, even if they don't agree with you, and let them know why this was important to you. I talked about the stories earlier, and each of us has a story of why, for us personally and for our constituents who we know and have suffered from illness, this is important. Mm-hmm. We as a country cannot ignore this, and we certainly can't get behind other countries in being able to have these breakthrough cures as well. And I, just to me, that's an easy argument to make. Mm-hmm. And if people still don't agree with you, well, I think you're going to find more people who do. But this was driving a lot of people to vote against the Cures Act.
Well, so luckily it passed.
Luckily it passed. But it is an issue. Mm-hmm. And those who have been around Washington for a long time acknowledge this problem with the way districts have been drawn and the fact that this primary challenge seems to drive a lot of people's behavior. And we've just got to get away from that. Mm-hmm. We've got to be able to
do the right thing.
To do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I know myself, when I have worked on something for a long time and have a judgment, you have to do what you feel after all the work that you've done. It's not a decision that you just come to quickly. You've worked really hard on trying to make sure that this is a step forward, not status quo or a step back. And when I can find that on balance something is better, and that the desire to move forward with this will make a difference for the country and certainly for my constituents here in San Diego, then even if it's taking a risk, I feel like it's the right thing to do.
Well, that's called leadership.
We have to do it.
I understand completely. And much as I hate to say it, our time is up. I want to thank you so much. It's been so terrific having you. And I want to thank our listeners and encourage listeners, if you want to be notified of future podcasts, go to extension.ucsd.edu, click on My Extension, and provide your email address. And if you have suggestions for guests you'd like to hear interviewed, please email me at careerchannel@ucsd.edu. For now, this is Leslie Bruce saying here's to your health.